This is Davis versus Cox.
Morning. My name is Bob Salk, and I'm here representing the appellants. I'd like to reserve 3 minutes of time. This case is about five members of the Olympia Food Co-op trying to force the co-op to follow its own procedures. What happened was the board passed a resolution in violation of those procedures, and in response to our complaint, an anti-SLAPP motion was filed. And in short, what happened was the trial court misapplied the statute, weighed the evidence against my clients, drew inferences against my clients, shifted the burden of proof to my clients, struck declarations of my clients, ignored other key evidence my clients put forth, rewrote the wording of the boycott policy to justify the trial court's decision, ignored definitions of words that the policy used, denied us discovery on grounds even the Constitution doesn't recognize, and failed to harmonize the anti-SLAPP statute with the civil rules, other statutes, and in fact our Constitution.
Well, assume you're right about weighing the evidence and not construing the evidence in light most favorable to you. If our review were to be de novo, we would do that. So the question is then why the board's action violated the bylaws if we assume for purposes of argument that the boycott policy qualified as speech under the statute.
Okay. Well, first, and I want to get to this, we don't believe the boycott policy is speech.
No, there's a lot written on
yeah.
that, and
okay.
I recognize it. So,
well, let's take it through. The boycott policy has two tests, basically. First, that there has to be, one must honor a nationally recognized boycott. So we'll start there. The second is that there must be a consensus, and that means of the staff, and consensus means unanimity. Nationally recognized boycott.
Can we start earlier? What's a policy?
That is the procedures that the board is bound to follow.
And where does it say that the board is bound to follow a policy?
Well, that's the evidence we put in. We put in declarations of board members.
If I were to look at the statute, the articles of incorporation, or the bylaws themselves, would I see written down anything that tells me that the board is obligated to adhere to a policy?
Yes. In fact, what you'd find is that the board is obligated to make policies and procedures, which is what they did in 1993 and failed to then follow. And in fact, Your Honor, if I may, I think a key fact this court missed, that is the trial court, is the board tried to amend the policies and couldn't. Now, think about that. If the board felt it wasn't bound by the policies, why is it trying to amend them? Now, at least it creates a question of fact, at a minimum, on that point. Second, if you read...
I think that's the reason for the first question that was asked, because given the recent development of the law, I think it's clear that at least at the second step, the Superior Court misstepped by entering findings and weighing evidence. And I think that notwithstanding the remedy sought, which might not allow for a jury, I think the procedure is the procedure. And so it has to accommodate a jury trial, right? So we're there. So then the question is this something that we can review and decide?
Well, I think
is it summary judgment-like, or in that review, does that necessitate a remand? Where does that error leave us? That's, I think,
I think you can and should decide it, but I also think there's a problem with the statute itself. And I think, with due respect, the Dillon case doesn't hit the right language. In Dillon, in dicta, you gave advice to future courts and how to deal with the burden of proof language relying on the Minnesota statute. The Minnesota statute is different than this one. The Minnesota statute says has a clear and convincing standard. And what this court said is in a case like that where there's a clear and convincing standard, you apply it as if there means in light of Rule 56. But that's not the standard here. The standard here is clear and convincing evidence of a probability. Now think about that for a minute. That's different. What that says is we have to prevail by a probability, but on the motion, we have to meet not a CR 56 standard, but a clear and convincing standard. That is a problem that creates all the separation of powers arguments, access to the court arguments that we put forth in our brief, that this court, that tiny little verbiage changes everything as far as the constitutionality of the statute. Now, to your question on whether you can decide, one thing I would say is we have had no discovery. So I don't think it can be decided against us if you decide. We've asked for discovery, and what the trial court said was, is the reason for us not getting discovery, two reasons. One, we asked for it too late. A reason not raised, I should say, by my colleague here, even though we asked for discovery within 30 days of getting their motion.
So with regard to this, the further discovery would reveal extrinsic evidence on the question of what is a policy and whether the board is required to follow it?
Correct, at a minimum, or it certainly could. I mean, what they did.
Well, the bylaws say that the board has the authority to adopt major policy changes. And so is it extrinsic evidence related to that provision of the bylaws?
Anything. In fact, that we know that the board tried to effect a policy change because we have the boycott policy. Here it is. We know the board tried to effect a policy change and failed. We know that. They've put in evidence by Mr. Levine.
In this case, there was a unanimous vote to engage in this boycott.
Correct.
Is that a major policy change?
It's not.
Or is that something else?
I don't believe it is, and that's what discovery might give us, because if it was a major policy change, Your Honor, there'd be no reason to amend the policy. That's the problem with it. I think, quite frankly, what's happened is there's a deep culture of staff consensus.
We know that.
And the board violated that, in an effort to change a boycott policy, to take staff consensus out, they failed. I'm out of time, and I'll save my next 3 minutes.
I'll hear big bylaws.
I'm handing up copies.
Oh, that's nice.
My name is Bruce Johnson. I'm here representing the respondents. With me is Angela Galloway.
Have you given a copy to Mr. Shulkin?
Mr. Shulkin has a copy. I'd like to address briefly one supplemental authority that was brought to the court's attention on Friday. It's a court from Illinois. We're not going to discuss it at length. I would simply refer the court to the amicus brief I filed in the Seventh Circuit on January 10th of that year, of this year, in connection with that particular decision by the district court. The Intercon case is the case that was cited late Friday by the appellants. We believe it's obvious that this is a classic slap beginning with the first lawyer threat all the way through the lawsuit. And we think for that reason, this is a very simple case to analyze. I call them prong one or prong two. Two basic points. One is this lawsuit, which concerns the Food Co-op Board's decision to boycott Israeli products, an action involving public participation and petition. And the statute says that the court must apply prong one regardless of the characterization that the plaintiffs give. It says it's defined as any claim, however characterized, that's based on an action involving public participation and petition. And we bear the burden of proving prong one, that is the preponderance by a preponderance of the evidence. In the two recent cases, City of Seattle versus Egan and the Dillon versus SDR case, the court cited favorably a California slap decision, Equilon Enterprises versus Consumer Cause, which, and quoted with approval, that states virtually identical public participation and petition test. The plaintiff's action arose from the defendant's activity in furtherance of its constitutional rights of speech or petition. That's exactly what happened here. Now, the appellants want to characterize this as sort of a dispute over corporate niceties. But in fact...
Doesn't that get to prong two?
That's prong two, Your Honor. And I'll address prong two next. But before we get to prong two, the thing to bear in mind is the NAACP versus Claiborne Hardware case. That was a decision from the U.S. Supreme Court in 1986. And in that case, the court said that all nonviolent elements of a boycott, including even the initial boycott decision by a local branch of a nonprofit, are protected under the First Amendment to the Constitution. So you can't really separate out these decisions, but you must look at the vote as part and parcel of how to get to a boycott decision. Second, and that's why we have the bylaws up here, bylaws basically say the affairs of the cooperative shall be managed by a board of directors. Unambiguous language, granting the board plenary authority, and furthermore establishing that the business and affairs of the cooperative shall be directed by the board of directors. There's nothing particularly unusual here. This is Hornbook law. A cooperative, a corporation, nonprofit or otherwise, is managed by its board, who are governed by its bylaws.
Let me ask you the same question I asked counsel. What's a policy?
A policy is probably anything.
An argument about a policy, but if I look at the statute, I look at the articles of incorporation, and I look at the bylaws, nothing defines a policy for me. There's references in the bylaws, but nothing defines what a policy is.
And in that regard, the business judgment rule comes into play. The court should defer to the judgment of the board itself as to what constitutes its policies and what constitutes its plenary authority under the bylaws.
And
so it's not really the noble.
Is there a requirement
review
that the board follow policies?
The board sets policies. That's the shall be managed by a board of directors. That's the Hornbook law that we're dealing with.
I understand that. Is that a policy? Do they have to follow it? In this case, there was unanimity not to follow a policy.
If you look at the boycott policy, you will see nothing that repeals the board's authority under the bylaws. You will see an empowerment granted to anybody in the organization to initiate a boycott, but completely absent from that is any statement that says, oh, and the board has no authority here. In fact, the board retained all authority that's contained in the bylaws, and RCW 24.03.0945 stresses that fact.
With regard to subsection 16 that you've got printed up on your handout and on the display here, in your briefing, you argue that this is applicable, and you did in the trial court, that this is applicable because there was basically an impasse with regard to this boycott proposal. Counsel argues that there can never be an impasse in a consensus-based organization, that the absence of unanimity is in and of itself a decision. So what's your take on the contrary argument to your position?
That would eliminate the board's ultimate fiduciary power to manage and direct the affairs of the organization. having one individual staff member block the board's decision-making power would completely interfere with how the corporation operates. I'd like to add another point about this, and that is this issue, as the court realized in the earlier questions, is an issue of law. The bylaws stand as a written document, unambiguous, and as the Supreme Court held in the Hearst Communications versus Seattle Times case, that is not subject to any particular extrinsic evidence. So the board, basically Mr. Sulkin argues that there was some weighing the evidence here. There wasn't. The court simply applied the bylaws and established as a matter of law that the board had authority, plenary managerial authority, to enter into a boycott or to change policies or to effectuate its own policies, sub-policies, who knows. But the board had that authority as a matter of bylaw, as a matter of the bylaws. And Mr. Sulkin was unable to find anything that established the board relinquished that ultimate authority in this particular corporation.
So your position is the board can adopt policies, but then it can ignore those policies if by consensus they choose.
In effect, it can amend policies, if you want to call it ignoring, but the board establishes policies. And the board has the ultimate business judgment rule behind it in establishing when a particular policy will be ignored, will be changed, will be modified, exactly what a legislature has. You pass a new law and you have ultimate plenary authority to run the corporation. Mr. Sulkin mentioned the clear and convincing test. This court is actually, we don't even have to go to Minnesota to deal with clear and convincing evidence. This court in the Sims versus Cairo case in 1978, the Supreme Court in Mark versus Seattle Times in 1981, clearly applied and understood that the prima facie case established for purposes of a summary judgment under Rule 56 is completely compatible with the civil rules. I'd also cite the Anderson versus Liberty Lobby case, where the U.S. Supreme Court in 1986 said there is absolutely no incompatibility between a clear and convincing evidence standard and the requirements of Rule 56. So there was no evidence weighed here. The court simply applied an unambiguous document and, perhaps touched by the business judgment rule, the fact that managerial authority resided exclusively in the board of directors. We would ask the court affirm the judgment below.
You just said there was no evidence weighed here, which then got my attention because we have findings of fact on some of these questions. It's your position that to the extent that the court found facts, that doesn't drive our de novo review of the issues presented.
The court found that there was a national boycott. The court also said this was unnecessary to its determination. And in effect, this was a summary judgment ruling. This court recognized that in the Dillon case, these are nothing different than a summary judgment ruling. So that whatever that finding of fact was, I don't think it was necessary to the judgment, and the court can apply de novo review as in any other summary judgment. So we would ask the court affirm the judgment below. We've also asked for attorney's fees pursuant to the anti-SLAPP law. Thank you.
I'd like to correct a misstatement my colleague made, I'm sure, unintentionally. What the court found was that there was no national boycott. Let me be clear. The court found no national boycott and then redefined what honor recognized national boycott to mean. It changed the definition of honored, ignored the definition of recognized, and reinterpreted boycott to mean a movement that's been not accepted anywhere in the country. That's what the court did. Okay? As to the policy itself, it says when a boycott request comes up, the merchandising coordinator will delegate the request to the staff. The department manager will make a written recommendation to the staff, who will decide by consensus. The department manager will post a sign informing customers of the staff's decision. This decision was given by corporate decision-making the board of directors to the staff, period. And there was no staff consensus. Doesn't say may, it says will.
But then the bylaws talk about resolving organizational conflicts. Does this fall within the parameters of that bylaw?
The short answer to that is no. The longer answer is, if I'm wrong, certainly we get discovery on it. But what the discovery showed from their own declarations was there's never been, this provision's never been applied to boycotts. What it really has been applied to are situations where one of the outlets of the co-op, they have a few, carries this brand and another carries that brand, or this wants, they want to pay $8 an hour and they want to pay $12 an hour, and there's a corporate function. It's never been applied to boycotts, and nothing in the policy says it gives that right back to the board, which is why the board's been trying to amend the policy itself.
But is there anything in the bylaws which explicitly says that the board is bound to, is bound by these policies that have been adopted, or this particular policy? Is there anything that
it's,
says that?
It's under board duties. The major duties of the board are to adopt policies to foster member involvement. It did here.
That's adopting policies. I'm asking, if once a policy has been adopted, is there anything in the bylaws that says the board can't choose to ignore
Well, certainly
policy?
The board believed that. That's why Levine put in a declaration saying we followed them.
But what I'm asking, is there anything in the bylaws that says that they can't do that?
There's nothing that says they can. There's nothing that says they can't. I think we can both interpret it our way. I think there's language in there that allows me to make it my argument, and certainly Mr. Johnson makes his argument. But a specific statement, Your Honor, no. What we do know is Levine believed they had to follow it. That's why Levine put in a declaration saying we did, even though he said we looked to international movement, not to a national boycott movement. So I think the short answer is by their conduct we know what it meant, what at least Levine thought and what the board thought. That is, they do have to follow the policy.
So does that support your argument that the language is ambiguous and extrinsic evidence is necessary to interpret the language policy?
I think it means two things. One, we win based on Levine's deposition because there is no national boycott, but at a minimum, yes.
Thank you.
Thank you.